Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, a Friday afternoon in Chicago, the weekend just ahead. We sit in the Showcase Studio, the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Tom Gimbel will be here a little bit later in this half hour, the CEO behind the LaSalle Network. And we're going to sit down and talk together and offer some advice to Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General. Actually, the idea is, he's
a little career advice.
Because Tom's the guy who can do it. And the idea is, what do you do when you butt heads publicly with your boss? And we'll talk to Gimbel about that. Cooper's Hawk later in the program as well. And then we'll look at the at R&D, the level of R&D done in Illinois, how it compares with other states and why it's important. But you just heard Andrea Haynes there. She's the editor for Blue Sky Innovation in the Chicago Tribune and comes by most Friday afternoons to talk to us about what's new in that world. Welcome back, Andrea.
Thanks, Steve.
Good to
be here.
You brought like a coterie of people with you.
I did. I decided I need to start bringing a posse, so I brought a really big one of students from Indiana University, which is my alma mater. So super thrilled to have them with us today.
Oh, welcome to all of you, and I'm sorry about your basketball program.
Dang.
Couldn't help it.
Cold.
Okay. Wait, so the news today is that Apple is going to cut off us Nano users?
No more Nano and no more Shuffle.
Is the Nano still, it's still made? You can still buy it?
Still get the Nano, still get the Shuffle. I have always said I was going to buy a Shuffle and I always never did.
Why would you ever buy a Shuffle?
It's so cute.
You really? Why you would buy it? Because you have no control over what it plays, right?
That's why everybody always talked me out of it. They were like, once you have it, you're not going to be that thrilled with it.
Yeah, I still have my Nano in my gym bag. Every morning I pick it up. And you know what I use it for? I wrap my headphones around it for my phone.
Oh, funny. So it's like a very expensive headphone
holder.
Yeah, I mean,
expensive. I might have thrown it out otherwise, but for some reason I've never gotten out of the habit. So yeah. I'll have to break the news to my Nano a little bit later.
Yeah.
The big news, a week ago today, we were talking about the big Pokemon Fest coming, Pokemon Go, coming to Grant Park, right?
Yep.
And the company that made it, they said they sold out in minutes. They wouldn't really say how many tickets they sold. It was kind of, there's this sort of mystique about the whole thing until it went south. And man, did it go south.
It really did. So we were monitoring this last Saturday, writing stories about it. It had a ton of interest. People, it turned out, traveled from far and wide.
Around the world.
From Germany, people from Canada, people from California, people from all over were super excited. And I get that, right? It's summer. It's a summer festival around something that if you collect those things, you play, you're super excited about it.
Give me two sentences on what Pokemon Go is so people understand.
It's a game on your phone, basically. You go out in person to kind of play it. So it encourages you. You get out, you walk around, you're looking, you're scanning, you're collecting via your phone, but out in the real world. So it's not like you're sitting at home doing it.
But you could play anywhere.
Yes.
Right? I mean, I could play on my block and play the same game that you would play on your block.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so they were all going to play on the same block here in Grant Park, and the game didn't work.
Yes. So there were a lot of incentives, too. There were special things you could capture, and, there were going to be things where people were playing in sync and all these other things. But they fairly quickly realized tons of people were there, tons of people showed up, but then the game just wasn't working, which is a problem when everybody's there to play the game, right? It's not like you're at a food festival and the game is ancillary. It was a game festival, so not the best.
And what was important business-wise here was that they were trying to figure out a way maybe to monetize their game or their product in a different way. Had it worked, or maybe they'll do it anyway, they could have had festivals around the country and raised more money that way.
Well, and they're still talking about that. So, we need to see how this all plays out, because now what we have is a potential, we have an actual lawsuit that's seeking class action status on behalf of all the players that spent a lot of money to travel to Chicago and play this game and wound up disappointed. So not what you want in your hot tech game.
And it was what? It was $20 for a ticket?
It was $20 for a ticket if you managed to get a ticket. They were definitely being resold at much higher prices. So some people may have paid more, in which case, maybe that's a buyer beware on that.
I was going to say, I can't sue you, right? If I bought for $20,
I don't think so. I think this is going more to, what I also think is interesting about it is we cover a lot of tech events and there's never good Wi-Fi and there's never, so to me, I'm kind of like, let's let's get everybody together. Like, let's talk to the cell phone carriers. Like, these venues need to figure that out, right? Everybody wants to be on their phones at big events. You know, in this case, the cell phone carriers are saying that they did everything right and they had mobile stations and everything should have been good. It's all, it's kind of a big mess. I think for Chicago, it's interesting because we want to be able to host things and we want to, you know, so to any extent that there's anything the city or the providers can do versus Niantic, who's the maker of the game.
Well, I guess that's a good question.
We maybe want to figure that out.
Do we know what happened then?
No one is really saying anything. You know, needless to say, there's lawsuits, so people are kind of clamming up.
Right.
Niantic, I think, has gone maybe, you know, it's kind of taking the blame, I think,
right.
Although it is suggesting that it didn't forget to check on cell network, so you kind of wonder what happened there. I don't think we really know yet.
All right, well, we'll follow that and learn more as they run into some reality. Another story this week, and some of these stories we've talked about, or some of them I've heard on the news but haven't quite been able to digest myself, this Roomba story, which is a vacuum, right? And the Roomba runs around your floors, vacuums it up. It's a robot. And now they want to develop technology so that they can map your house. Is that what the story is?
It is. So it sounds like, it is one of those you look at and go, is it that exciting to have a map of my house? Like,
right.
You know, is that really going to help anybody? But I think the idea is that they would potentially sell this to, you know, companies that are doing the smart home type of technology, and that can help them in figuring out your house and marketing things to you and ultimately running your smart home.
So maybe it's the sort of thing where they don't know who they're going to sell it to yet, right?
Or, yeah, it sounds pretty fledgling, honestly. It sounds like it's pretty fledgling, but it's interesting to think of. I know it seems like almost every week there's somebody new that's gathering our data,
right.
So we feel a little bit of a responsibility to
How many Roombas are there out there?
A lot.
Really?
Yeah, there are. Like, people on my staff have them, so I'm like, I didn't know that, like, you know, it's totally out there now. I'm not sure the story has a number, but more people have them than you think.
That surprises me. I wouldn't think. To me, that's one of those gizmos that you would, you know, buy at some specialty
shop.
That's
how I
thought
of it. But I think they've gotten a lot more mass adoption than you and I might think.
All right. Well, bring one in next week. We'll see. We'll have it clean the studio.
Send it around.
Yep. One other thing, you wrote a piece, not so much about a new business, but about how to present. No. Okay. I should say, Andrea wrote a piece about chairs and the chairs that people sit in and how difficult they are for women when it's sort of bar stool height. What do you call it? A bistro chair, maybe?
It is. Yeah, sometimes they call them highboy tables and therefore highboy chairs. Some people just call them bar stools.
So, of course, everyone missed it, but I was very happy to have a bar stool chair for you when you walked in today.
Yes, a nice high director chair, which in my opinion is basically the worst.
All right, so it's bad for women. Women hate it. Why?
So this is for like panel discussions, for work type events. They invite you to speak. You know, you're there to share your expertise, and you get there and you see some incredibly frightening chair you have to climb up on and like brace yourself on for an entire hour. So I wrote a story that I hope was funny. It was an essay. It was meant to be funny, but it was recounting literally the years that I have watched women executives. I watched a Nobel laureate whose shoes fell off.
I love that.
Because she was on a high stool. She was giving a talk to an audience.
Right.
And literally her shoes fell off.
Well,
do you want that? You invite a Nobel laureate?
It just doesn't work well, especially for women and women's wardrobe. I love them because I'm 6'5 and wear pants.
Yeah, so you're maybe the rare person that they're actually made for. But I have to say, I've heard from tons of people who not necessarily encounter them in business, but just the average person who encounters them in restaurants.
Right.
People have written me passionate letters about them. They really, really, really do not like these chairs.
That's the thing about having a voice. Sometimes you strike a nerve and you have no idea it's coming.
Yep.
Andrea Haynes, have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks, Steve.
Teach these young people from Indiana lots of things.
We'll do. Thanks again for having us.
We'll take a break. Be back with Tom Gimbel, Jeff Sessions, and the president on the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Tom Gimbel is in the studio, the CEO, the creator, the force behind the LaSalle Network. Welcome back, Tom Gimbel.
Good to see you.
We talk about workplace issues, and let's do Donald Trump and Jeff Sessions,
sure.
Right? When your boss is publicly berating you, or maybe we can do Anthony Scaramucci and Reince Priebus. There are a lot of different relationships in the White House where people are being very publicly, very vocally opposed to each other.
And I think there's, you know, the Priebus one with Scaramucci is really interesting because usually Scaramucci's position would report to Priebus.
Right, right.
And instead it's reporting to the president, de facto CEO, right?
Which is maybe another topic.
And
right?
you see that happen a lot in companies is when the CEO hires somebody that he or she really likes. And they want to have more interaction with them because they know it's going to be successful. They go, oh, you know what? You can report directly to me.
How often does that work out well?
It usually kind of happens like this without the New Yorker article or right, whatever, right. New York Magazine, whatever
New
it
York
was.
New York Magazine, yeah.
Yeah. But it usually sends a message that somebody's not right for something.
Right. All right, so Jeff Sessions, I saw him being interviewed. I think he's in El Salvador.
Right.
And, you know, he was asked, what do you make of this? The president, you know, openly. And again, for people who don't pay a lot of attention to it, this has never happened. I mean, this just doesn't happen where a president is outwardly, vocally opposed to his own attorney general.
Correct.
Right?
Who he handpicked.
Because a lot of times the attorney general will end up looking into the administration so they don't like each other that much, but that they would be so clearly opposed.
Saying that, right. It sends a clear message. And I think what Sessions is, it's a very different issue in politics, right? He's saying, I'm serving out my country.
Right.
I'm proud to have gotten this position, whether it's Trump or somebody else. I believe in a conservative agenda, and I'm here to execute that. If you translate that over to corporate America and your boss is publicly saying bad things, publicly, maybe internally publicly,
sure,
right, but disparaging you, you really have to figure out, why are you there? And that's the hard part about corporate America, right? You're there for the paycheck. It's hard to walk away from a job.
To leave a paycheck, right?
Yeah, right.
So that's an interesting distinction because Sessions, why is Sessions there? I mean, he's really being an activist. He really is doing a lot of the things that they campaigned on. So he is making a difference in that way, whether you like the idea or not.
Absolutely. Philosophically, putting those views aside, he took this job because of a conservative agenda that he believed in to go and take that, and he wants to fulfill that. I mean, it looks that way from the outside.
Right.
And so if you're hired into a company and you're doing a role that you really want to do and your boss is disparaging you, the question is really, is your day-to-day work fulfilling for you? And do you want to tolerate that? Is it once a week they're disparaging you, once a quarter, once a year?
Do you put your head down and do your job, or do you go in there and say, what the hell's going on here?
The ability to walk into your boss's office and the right way, and we've coached both sides of this, is to say, talk to him, can I get some time on your calendar, him or her, and say, is there something I've done that you're not happy with? Because let me know so I can change how I'm communicating to make you happy.
Right.
Right?
At what point does it become, you know, say your job is fulfilling, but it looks like Sessions will be gone eventually, right? And so he's not the perfect example here. If you're in corporate America and you're being berated or you're being belittled, eventually you're going to be fired, and then you're going to need to find the next job. There must be sort of a sliding scale or a balance to when the paycheck, keeping the paycheck, is really doing you more long-term damage than cutting loose right away.
Well, what I'll tell you is this, Steve, is a lot of employers or a lot of managers, they don't want the person to be gone. They just don't know how to manage.
No.
And they say things in public, and they say, well, we're just talking about everything. They don't realize it, and that's when this EQ and emotional intelligence has become a big thing in the past 10 or 12 years.
I love it. You don't like that, do you?
Right? I like it, and it's accurate, but it's no one has perfect at it, right? I mean, you're supposed to be great with every person in every role. It's impossible. And so it really comes down to how it's affecting you overall. Certain people get stressed if you say, we're going to switch desks today.
I do, yeah.
Right?
I do. I'm better at it now, but I used to be very bad at those things.
How you interpret being berated is really a different issue. And it's really, the bigger the company, the more chance there may be to have a mentor program or a really proactive HR. And you have to go out and source other people's opinion.
It's an excellent point. So there may be people out there who could be berated the way Sessions is and not even recognize it as abuse.
Or a lesser extent being berated, so it's really not that bad, and making it, magnifying
right,
it,
right.
Like it's really something.
So it's what you bring to the table as well.
I mean, Sessions, if that were happening to you at work, that's real.
Right.
Right. If someone says, I'm unhappy with what your performance is, that's management.
Right. And you have to be able to hear that.
You have to be able to take it. Yeah, right. I always say the best employees I've ever worked with, I've ever placed, I've ever coached, are the ones who want to hear bad news about their performance. If you want to hear what you're doing wrong, then you really want to improve. When you don't want to hear bad news, your head's in the sand.
I'm always willing to say that I want to hear the bad news.
Well, you get yours automatically because you get ratings.
But I don't really want to hear the bad news. Tom Gimbel, the CEO of LaSalle Network. Thanks for coming by.
Always good to be with you.
It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We're listening along with Matt McMillan, who's here from Cooper's Hawk. I almost said this is the Cooper's Hawk. That would have been a big mistake.
That's okay.
Welcome. How are you? Nice to see you again.
Pleasure to be here.
Matt is the executive chef for Cooper's Hawk, and I met Matt at the opening of the Oak Park restaurant, 10 days ago, a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, two Saturdays ago.
How's it going there?
It's spectacular. Off to the races, we've been incredibly welcomed, you know, by the chamber and the community there, and the restaurant's doing incredible.
That's number, I can never keep track.
29.
Number 29. Right. And then number 30 comes in Reston, Virginia.
Yeah, a few weeks. Yeah, a few weeks in Reston.
So the point is, and I told the listeners earlier, you and I had a conversation just about running multiple kitchens, about food, about ingredients that really interested me. And so I wanted you to come in and talk about it.
Sure.
So you manage 29 different restaurants and their food, right?
Well, not all by myself.
Not all by yourself. But yeah, how do you, you know, if it's a McDonald's, you know, you've got a giant supply chain. You've got, you know, the vendors are set and all of that.
Right.
How do you, and same menu every restaurant?
Same menu in every restaurant, same pricing strategy.
How do you set up a supply chain, or say a new one opens in Reston where you don't have other stores? How do you figure out how to get the same sort of fresh food there as you do here or in Kansas City or wherever?
Great question. And it all comes down to our team. So we have, you know, departments that are responsible for certain things. And on the supply chain side, we have great people and people that have kind of been there and done that before. So there's certain items that are obviously easy to get in every market, you know, cream, cheese,
right,
you know, butter, sugar, those sorts of commodities. But then there's some really special items that we move around the country. And, you know, we're fortunate that our restaurants are successful. We do some pretty good volume. So, for instance, and one of the things you'll taste later is our gnocchi. So I brought some gnocchi carbonara, one of my favorite dishes on our menu.
The studio is filled with food. It's very hard for you not to reach over and grab some.
And we have this wonderful Italian family in Franklin Park that actually makes these ricotta gnocchi for us.
Okay.
And we ship them all over the country. So they're shipped to what we call a DC or a distribution center with our broadliner in every market, and then the restaurants just pull from that supply. So we do that with certain products that are specific to Cooper's Hawk. And we have a lot of products like that because we use very high-quality products.
So we were talking about that, and you know, I said, what distinguishes a menu or a meal? And I think I might have preempted you by saying, don't tell me ingredients. Because, or the freshness of the ingredients, I said, because I can't tell that. I can't tell if this arugula is that much better than that arugula. But people in the restaurant business always say we use the freshest ingredients. And I just thought there must be something different than that. But you tell me no. And tell me why the ingredients or how the ingredients matter.
I think it's deeper. You know, for a chef, we'll always say ingredients and fresh ingredients. But for me, it's the specific ingredient or the specific brand. So over the course of a career, you glean certain ingredients and brands of oils and vinegars and salts that you become used to using and that you love to use and that you feel make a difference. So I have something that I always say, you know, if you come to the restaurant and you taste something, you may not know the specific ingredient, but you know, and you leave with this emotional experience that, wow, that was really good.
Right.
I don't know why, but I know that was really good. And I think, conversely, you can have a bad experience and you're like, why was that? It wasn't seasoned properly, or it was a cheap oil or a cheap vinegar or a mayonnaise.
So I'm not going to walk out saying, wow, that was a really bad oil.
Right.
But I'm going to walk out saying, well, that fish wasn't quite what I was hoping for.
Exactly. Exactly. Maybe the fish is, you know, one day past its prime, you know,
right,
and you're like, I didn't care for it. Well, you know, as a chef, our team, we can taste something and say, yeah, the oil was rancid, or the fish was or, you know, the vinegar was kind of a cheap vinegar, you know. So those sorts of fats stay on your palate. And then acid is kind of what washes away that, and they balance. So if you have an oil that's just a low quality and you put it in your mouth, you're not super sophisticated, it either tastes great or it doesn't.
You still told me a story about mayonnaise. And that you could change, that you instantly made an impact with different mayonnaise.
Right. Yeah. So, when I started with the company, first thing I always do, like even if I visit a friend's restaurant, you know, I walk into the storeroom and I say, you know, what kind of chef is this? Just by the types of ingredients that they use. And for us, you know, we upgraded our mayonnaise. That was one of the first things that I did.
Yeah.
And literally more than doubled the price of the mayonnaise. But again, you know, working with Tim for as long as we have, you know, we recognize that those things make a difference. They're one of the first things that hit your palate. And when you put them side by side, you know, sometimes you can't really tell, or you taste something, you're like, I'm not quite sure exactly, you know, why I like this or why I don't like this. But when you put two very opposite tasting things, a higher quality product and a lower quality product, such as mayonnaise, side by side,
you can
taste them. Oh my God. Another thing is salt. You know, the difference between using a great iodized salt, or I'm sorry, a great kosher salt, you know, and using just iodized salt. You know, when I would do cooking classes, I would actually teach people to taste the difference between the salts that they have in their cabinets, especially an iodized salt and a kosher salt. And it's amazing.
You can make a difference.
How pure. Well, you know, kosher salts are very pure. Iodized salts have a lot of impurities. And when you taste them side by side, lights out. I mean, there's a huge difference.
All right. So there's essentially one menu in every restaurant. The restaurants are in different regions of the country.
Correct.
So it's got to be a menu of wide appeal.
Right.
This wasn't from you, but someone else told me about a 20-60-20 rule.
Sure.
When it comes to menus.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
So it's, you know, when we're coming up with food, we try to make sure that we're filling all the gaps on our menu. And this was something that just kind of bubbled up, and it gave us a framework, more or less, to figure out what type of dish is this and where would this fit on the menu. So the 20-60-20 that we talked about is, so 20% of our menu are like very simple, straightforward, great versions of food. A burger, a chicken piccata, so to speak. And then we have 60% of our menu, which is that the main chunk of our menu that are what we call classics with a twist. Okay. So like, I mentioned the chicken piccata before. You know, we squeeze fresh lemon juice into every chicken piccata right before it goes out of the kitchen. And that's what people taste, you know. And you can buy, quote unquote, fresh squeezed lemon juice, but it's not the same thing. And they're the little things that make a difference.
And then the other 20?
And then the back 20 are very kind of culinary forward, you know, sort of dishes, like, you know, we've got our Brussels sprouts here, and we've got, you know, this beautiful cheese plate with the candied bacon, our pork belly tostadas, that's kind of this Chinese red braised pork belly with a little Latin twist,
right.
You know, so these newer culinary forward dishes, and we hope to expand that over time.
What is the ingredient that you throw away most?
Wow. I'd like to say nothing.
Right. But, I mean, there must be something.
Ingredient that we
throw away most. I mean, there must be something that the freshness depends on, or that it's, you know, the whim of the customer.
Oh,
or
I would say it's probably lemon juice, citrus.
Really?
So, you know, every day we squeeze, you know, a case or cases of lemon juice, and it's used in a variety of different places in the kitchen. So we try to prep it as tight as we can.
Sure, absolutely.
But, you know, there may be a cup or two cups at the end of the day that is just, it's never as good the next day.
A cup or two cups. If you're only throwing away a cup or two cups of ingredients at the end of the night, you're pretty good with procurement.
Well, we're really tight on our prep. I mean, so we have great systems in our restaurant where every day the chefs come in and they're looking at what do we have, what do we need to prep, and they know the business, you know, that's there, right. and they keep it tight.
I have so many questions and we're out of time. But so obviously I would imagine that you can see a different in regional taste by what people order where.
Our menu mix will shift, you know, so we'll sell more grouper down in Florida than we will, you know, say salmon.
Right.
But you know, for the most part, you know, our top selling appetizers are everywhere, you know, but entrees, I would say they fluctuate a little bit more regionally.
Yeah. Matt McMillan, the executive chef, Cooper's Hawk. Thanks for coming. It's great to see you again.
Steve, great to see you. Always a pleasure.
It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Friday afternoon. All right, let's talk research and development. How's that for a topic? Mark Harris is on the phone line. He is the president and the CEO of the Illinois Science and Technology Coalition. Mark, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Okay, so I'm just thinking, you know, we were just talking about food and the restaurant business and tastes, palates, and all of that. And now we go to research and development. And I think that a lot of people might not realize just how, important research and development is. But also, it seems to me, and you tell me, but it seems to me it's sort of been under siege in the past few years. So tell me a little bit about the Illinois Science and Technology Coalition and why you look at research and development.
Yep. So, yeah, the ISTC, we're a member-driven nonprofit statewide. We really work to measure, connect, and enrich the state's research and tech innovation community, and that means bringing together a lot of different public and private partners to do that. We have a publication called the Illinois Innovation Index, So we look at a lot of different areas of the state sort of innovation ecosystem and really put some numbers to measure and benchmark our performance to our peers and to the nation and just kind of see where we're headed. And yeah, as you said, research and development, I mean, it's really the lifeblood of innovation, whether it's from the university research context where new discoveries are coming out of the labs to what corporations are doing to innovate and develop new products, services. But it's so crucial because a lot of these are long-term investments that both companies and the federal government makes to advance science and advance quality of life. And this current administration has really put an axe in his introduced budget to R&D and a lot of the agencies that fund that. So National Institutes of Health, NSF, the National Science Foundation, Department of Energy, all agencies that Illinois pulls down a large concentration of funding from. So it's really important that we put a spotlight on this activity.
And the idea is that it's not easy money to spend because you're not going to get an instant payoff. You might not get a payoff at all, but when you do, not only will it pay off in spades, but also it's important. It's important that we move forward and make this investment.
Yep. No, that's correct. And in terms of the numbers that we can get into, I mean, when we really set out to do this report, we wanted to, you know, look at the lens of where we fare nationally and sort of where we're strong and where we're also lagging.
Right. Illinois is in the top 10, right? So does that mean we're doing okay? Does that mean we're very good, or how does that rank?
Yeah. You know, it's a mixed bag. I'd say first and foremost, you're right, we're a powerhouse. So Illinois has world-class universities, some of the most innovative companies anywhere. And so we are, nationally speaking, a leader. What I think is still something we're focusing on and what this report highlighted is that the growth has been relatively flat over the last several years. So from the really period from 2010 to 2014, we grew about 0.2% relative to the nation's 4% growth. So it's an area that I think we want to ensure we're continuing to focus on. And obviously some of the industries where we're strong in Illinois, where it's pharmaceuticals, machine manufacturing, finance and insurance, and food, all remain really key strengths.
Well, you talked about government, the federal government, and what they're spending on research and development, and in the state government as well. But really, isn't this mostly, I wonder, Mark, because isn't this most, I think business spends it overwhelmingly when it comes to the money spent on research and development. And not only that, it's, you know, it's individual. So, I mean, what AbbVie might be spending doesn't really relate to what Ford might be spending. So what's the value here and looking at both of them together or all of it cohesively?
Yeah, so no, that's correct. Just to give you a flavor for the numbers, there's $16 billion dollars spent in R&D, roughly $16 billion in Illinois, and 12.5 of that, so the lion's share of that, comes from industry. 2.5 is from universities, and another billion from our two federal labs, Argonne and Fermi. What we're seeing kind of all total when we look at the R&D enterprise is that some interesting trends are emerging in terms of collaboration between industry and academia. So from a pre-competitive basis, companies like Baxter and Abbott and Takeda on the health side are partnering with our universities at the research level to sort of advance those partnerships and discoveries and ideally sort of pool together in a more kind of comprehensive and strategic way in light of the potential cuts on the federal side.
Mark Harris, the president, CEO of the Illinois Science and Technology Coalition. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.